Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:40 on the afternoon, 1:50, I'm sorry, in the afternoon of January 31st, 2011. We were delayed a few minutes as we had four of the five members of the Judiciary Committee and this bill's sponsor up in the Finance Committee listening to school boards from across Alaska make a strong presentation to us. And so I wanted to extend us for a few minutes up there. It seemed very worthwhile. And so thanks, everybody who had to wait for us. Apologize, but just the crush of business in the 90-day session. We are here today to hear two bills, Senate Bill 31 and Senate Bill 33. We'll start with Senate Bill 31. You should all have in front of you a new CS, / echo, and if we could get a motion to adopt that.
I would make that motion, Mr. Chair.
Is there objection? Hearing none, / echo is the bill before us, and we have the bill sponsor. We also have able staff from my office and his, who I think may be the ones making the presentation. Senator Thomas, did you want to come forward and say a few words? Welcome to the committee.
This is an unusually small table here.
Anyhow, but it's efficient, highly efficient.
Efficient, that's right. Oh, good afternoon, and thank you for hearing Senate Bill 31, an act relating to the counting of ballots. Senate Bill 31 looks to clarify our statute by utilizing language recommended in the Miller versus Treadwell decision of the Alaska Supreme Court and reinforced by the State Superior Court as well as the Federal District Court. This language is nearly identical to the Federal Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. This states explicitly that the Director of the Divisions of Elections will use the determination of a voter's intent as the guiding principle when counting and judging a write-in ballot's validity. Senate Bill 31 incorporates the concept Alaskan courts have applied consistently for 50 years, favoring voter intent. The primary goal of Senate Bill 31 is twofold. First, to clarify our statute language to ensure that in future elections, as many Alaskans are enfranchised as possible. The second is to clarify existing language and strengthen the public perception of Alaska's democratic process. Senate Bill 31's goal of ensuring voter enfranchisement and putting into statute inclusive rather than exclusive language will protect the fundamental democratic rights of Alaskans who enter the polling booth with diverse backgrounds, abilities, and skills. Thank you for your time and attention to this simple yet important bill. I urge your support of Senate Bill 31, and my staff, Greyer Hopkins, has some additional comments and information he would like to add, if that would be possible.
Excellent. Thank you, Senator Thomas. Let me just stop for a moment because I think I forgot to announce the roll, which is one of the things you always have to do when you start a committee meeting. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Paskvan, myself, Senator French, Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Coghill. So thank you for that good overview, Senator Thomas. Let's turn to Mr. Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greyer Hopkins. I'm staff to Senator Joe Thomas. Thank you also for having me here today and for hearing Senate Bill 31, an act relating to the counting of write-in votes. Senate Bill 31 follows on the heels of nearly 50 years of court precedent here in Alaska, spanning numerous cases and election issues, all finding in favor strongly of voter intent. As you can see from the page in your bill entitled Quotes of Significance to Senate Bill 31 from the United States Senate Court Findings, each court decision used strong language stating the importance of voters' intent and also that the state statute language regarding the subject of write-in votes is murky and is left open to numerous interpretations. Senate Bill 31 looks to clarify this problem by utilizing language recommended in the Miller v. Treadwell decision of the Alaska Supreme Court, like Senator Thomas said. This language is nearly identical to the Federal Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. This language lays out explicitly that the division will use the determination of a voter's intent as their guiding principle when counting and judging the validity of write-in ballots. As Senator said also, the intent of Senate Bill 31's change is twofold. First, to clarify our state statute and to ensure that in future elections, as many Alaskans as possible are enfranchised, and throwing out a ballot based simply on a minor error such as an abbreviation or a misspelling will not happen as long as the director of the division is able to determine the voter's intent. This allows write-ins such as Lisa M. to still not meet the voter's intent determination because it does not appear as it did on the declaration of candidacy, which is required under 15-15-360A-11. The word appears came under substantial scrutiny by the courts, where they determined that if the legislature had intended to require a perfect spelling in the write-in field, they would have used a more specific term such as identical, perfect, or the same as. The word appears according to the court, is meant to show some latitude left by the legislature in what would be accepted by the division when judging a ballot. Murkowski with a C, for example, would still be close enough to appear like Murkowski on the declaration of candidacy, while Lisa M. would not. The second reason for Senate Bill 31 is to tighten our state statute and strengthen the public's perception of Alaska's democratic process. Having clear, concise statute language showing how the votes are determined will alleviate some of the outcry we have seen since November 2nd. Hopefully, also, it will reduce the potential for future litigation. Currently, to date, the state of Alaska has spent over $150,000 on this court case itself. I would like to take the opportunity to point out two additional documents in your bill packet, the letter of support from the Alaska Federation of Natives and a sample brochure from the Disability Law Center of Alaska. Both of these organizations represent a substantial number of voters in Alaska who would be directly assisted by this bill, and they are both in support of the importance of voter enfranchisement and the voter's intent being paramount. Senate Bill 31's goal of ensuring enfranchisement and putting into statute inclusive as opposed to exclusive language will protect the fundamental democratic voting rights of Alaskans who enter the polling booth with a variety of backgrounds. Thank you again, and I urge your support of Senate Bill 31. I'm available for any questions. Additionally, we have Gail Fanumiai, the Director of the Division of Elections, who just underwent this whole process, and Sarah Felix, who played an important role in the court cases following November 2nd. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Questions for the bill's sponsor or his able staff? I'll start. We have a CS / echo that is different from the one that was presented down in the State Affairs Committee. I know some of the members were there for that. I was. You were. Senator Wilkowski, of course. Maybe you could talk about, if you're knowledgeable, you can talk about, or perhaps my staff can discuss, the differences between that earlier version and the one we have today.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Smith. Cindy Smith, who is appearing on camera for the first time this year and who is, of course, the Judiciary Committee staffer, my chief of staff, and extremely welcome before this committee. Please put yourself on the record and let us know what's different.
For the record, my name is Cindy Smith. I'm staff to Senator French. After the state affairs hearing, the Division of Elections and Department of Law asked us to take a look at the state affairs version just because there are duties within that B / B Bravo version that are specific to the election boards and others that were specific to the director. The Bravo version had included the phrase the election board and or director, I think. And so instead of doing that, they asked us to break those duties out. So that creates a new section D in the committee substitute that's before you. But what it is the former numbers 9 through 13 in version Bravo. So,
okay,
so what has happened is we've simply dropped we've taken the provisions that actually are those that are performed by the director and put them into a separate section, leaving the current law as it stands, where election boards are specifically in charge of particular activities.
Let me see if I understood you. The last version I have, I'm not sure what other members of the committee have, and it may not be instructive or that necessary for them to follow, but the last version I have is / I, India, from previous hearings. And it began with 1515-360A and listed 13 subsections of Section A.
Okay. Excuse me. I was actually working from the work draft, which was labeled Bravo, but the final one is I. It's the same.
Okay.
Document.
Same one.
Yeah.
And are you saying that parts of what I see in now / echo, the version before the committee, were pulled out of 360A?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Other questions? Go ahead.
Numbers 9 through 13 in India are now taken out into Section D. That leaves the original language, which is actually already statutory language, in place.
And just to scratch my legislative drafting itch, in the past, when I see something that like that take place, I would expect to see 1515-360A and have the parts that are disappearing be in bold or be in caps so that it would be leaving, so that it would be a signal to those who are watching the statute that it's leaving that part of the statute. Am I missing something? Am I expressing myself?
I will defer that question to the legislative drafter,
okay.
Mr. Bullard.
Okay, we'll wait till we get Mr. Bullard here or someone like that. So previously we had talked about the election board or director, and the Division of Elections is happy with having this version before us in /echo deal with that issue.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, is that their request, and they've reviewed it.
Great. Further questions for two staffers? We do have the division here, and I'm sure we'll want to hear from them. Senator Coghill, no?
I have some questions. I'm not too sure where they fit in. It really is into the wordsmithing of it, Mr. Chairman, so maybe I'll go ahead and let the drafter come in and
bring that person forward. Fair enough. Then thank you both. If you both stand by, we may have further questions. Maybe before we get too deep into the weeds, we'll take public testimony and hear what's on the mind of the public that may help inform us when we pose our questions. We've got two folks signed up to testify who are not in the room. Marilyn Russell in Fairbanks with the League of Women Voters. Ms. Russell, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
All right, thank you. Yeah, this is Marilyn Russell, and I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Alaska. And I would like to say that we, the League of Women Voters of Alaska, support Senate Bill 31 because it ensures the greatest number of voters are enfranchised to the greatest extent possible. We've always supported efforts to expand voting and voting rights to as many citizens as possible. And that is what this bill does. It gives more flexibility. If a name is misspelled, the voter's intent will be respected. Thank you very much for listening. That's it.
Very good. Thank you much, Ms. Russell, for your short and to the point testimony. We always like that kind.
You're welcome.
Next up is in Anchorage, Jerry McCutcheon. Mr. McCutcheon, please put yourself on the record. If you can hear my voice, state your name and affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony. Mr. McCutcheon, Jerry McCutcheon. Not getting him? Looking to see if anyone can tell if he's online or if we're just not hearing him.
Here we go. I'm sorry. My fault.
Fair enough. Jerry McCutcheon, put yourself on the record.
My name is Jerry McCutcheon, MC, capital C, UTCHEON. The Alaska legislature is the all-powerful legislature of the 50 states. If you legislators will read the Alaska's Constitution carefully, particularly Article 3, Section 16, and Article 4, Section 1, you will see that the legislature is the all-powerful legislature of the 50 states, and that both the executive and the judiciary are dependent upon the legislature for their power. In fact, you may only have one branch of government, the legislature. There may be two, the executive and the legislature. I have not researched that far enough. But the state of Alaska most certainly does not have three branches of government like the other states. The Alaska's judiciary is a total creature of the legislature, Article 4, Section 1 of the Alaska's Constitution, and serves at the pleasure of the legislature. In short, judiciary is an arm of the legislature. Shocking. The judiciary would just as soon the legislature did not know that fact. The legislature can dispose of the judiciary with 11 votes in the Senate and 21 votes in the House. The executive is prohibited from exercising power or challenging the legislature in Article 3, Section 16, which says the authority shall not be construed to authorize any action or proceeding against the legislature. Unlike other states, Alaska is neither, in Alaska, neither the executive nor the judiciary have domain over the legislature, but the legislature has domain over the executive and the judiciary. The judiciary cannot give power it does not have to the executive. The legislature must expressly give the judiciary power over the legislature, or the judiciary does not have, or can the judiciary conjure up power that it does not have and give that power to the executive. Thus, the election counting and the votes outside of the law was not valid, nor can the judiciary give the executive the power that just because the legislature has never given the power to the judiciary. As far as I know, Joe Miller never raised the constitutional issue. Miller was too busy throwing rocks. The executive is well aware of the fact that they and the court had no authority to do in the election, and this is why the executive is scrambling to obtain legislative clarification. This would not change the outcome of the election, just the way the votes are counted. You are the all-powerful legislature of the 50 states. Keep it that way. Be very careful of what legislative powers you legislators give away. The legislature is the law. And yes, there is a case before the court challenging the court's authority. They would rather you did not know about it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. McCutcheon, your testimony came in just at 3 minutes. That's excellent. Questions for Mr. McCutcheon? I don't see any. Again, thank you, sir. We also have in the room Sarah Felix. Perhaps Ms. Felix could come forward and or online. Oh, there she is. Yep. Yep. Ms. Felix, nice to see you. Please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to come forward with Elections Director Gail Fanumiai, if that's all right with
that's
you.
That's completely fine. I noticed she marked in there, but maybe I didn't read her ballot correctly. or maybe it's just wishful thinking, but welcome to the committee. It's nice to see you here. Please put yourselves both on the record, and then we'll go ahead and hear from you.
Sarah Felix from the Attorney General's Office in Juneau.
Gail Fanumiai, Division of Elections.
If you have some views on the bill, we'd like to hear them.
Actually, we're just here at the convenience of the committee. If there are questions, we understood there would be questions from the committee. As Cindy Smith stated, we've worked with the drafter, and the bill addresses the concerns that we had. And
you're happy with it?
Yes.
Thank you. And my staff pointed out for me that on page 2, line 28, section 3 of the bill contains the repealers of the earlier sections that I was puzzled about. And so the bill is in good form from that perspective. Senator Coghill, did you want to start off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, there's a couple questions. And Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I didn't get to hear this in the prior committee.
State Affairs Committee, and take your time.
And this is the first time I've had a chance to look at this in any depth, so some of the questions may be or have already been answered.
That's fair. I think a good hearing is better than a short one. And just for the committee's understanding, the bill will be held over. It will not be leaving today, so plenty
Thank
of time
you.
To look
Appreciate
it over.
That, Mr. Chairman. One of the questions I had on the first page on line 7, the basis of other evidence, that probably is a standard that something has already been decided on, but it was the first time it caught my eye, and I was wondering under D1 there on line 7, 6 and 7, the director determines on the basis of other evidence that the ballot was so marked for the purpose of identifying the ballot. Can you help me understand that?
Through the chair, Representative Senator Coghill, I think that was in the existing statute.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're looking at all the bases, Mr. Chairman, I thought time to ask.
I think it's a fair question. I mean, maybe you can just kind of explain how that would work in real life, what a ballot would look like if it were so marked, if you've come across them.
Through the chair, I can give you an example.
Great.
I think what happened during the count is there were approximately 20 ballots where a voter would write in Joe Miller as the write-in and also vote for Joe Miller as
the candidate.
Pre-printed candidate.
Sure.
And those votes would be counted for Joe Miller.
Okay.
That's how that would be applied.
Just once, of course.
Just
right. But so I guess I'm like Senator Kotko. I'm just a little bit phrased about what that line on line 7 means, that the ballot was so marked for the purpose of identifying the ballot. What is that? That's an English phrase that sort of eludes
perhaps
me.
Mr. Chairman, a voter would write their name on the ballot or something like that.
Are keeping track of it, like this is my ballot, or?
And there are other statutes not set out in this bill that prohibit the division from counting a ballot where a voter has put an identifying mark on it.
Interesting. Okay, so if the ballot has been marked in a way that would identify the voter who cast it, you don't count it. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Fenumani, is that correct?
That would be my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, all right. Then we're through Section 1. Good question.
Yep. Yeah, that sure helps me because I was trying to think what that might be. For example, if not following the direction, the oval was filled outside of the oval. You know, I mean, the marking was outside the oval. Is that a voter intent?
Through the chair, is your question if a voter marks outside the oval?
Right. And that's actually where my mind went to when they said for other purpose. I was thinking if the marking is outside the oval, certainly your counters don't count it, so it goes into a hand count. At that point, my guess is the other evidence is, you know, this is where my mind was turning, is that you would see that as voter intent.
Through the chair, I think there's another statute that says if they don't touch the oval, it has to touch the oval. If they make a mark that's not touching the oval, it's not counted.
And when we're talking about touching, we're talking about filling in the oval.
Yeah, right. No. As long as they make a mark, it could be a dot in the oval.
That's enough to get you started.
I thought, through Mr. Chairman, that Senator Coghill was asking about a mark totally away from the oval.
When I was in the Senate, when I was in the House, Mr. Chairman, Senator did roll off the tongue, and now Representative seems to roll off the tongue. So.
I apologize.
Man without a country, but you're very welcome here, so please continue.
Well, the question was, because I'm going to the whole intent thing, if you have a first name and a middle initial, which I saw in part of this discussion, and you that is not done according to what we had normally thought should be the full name, then this other evidence, my mind immediately went to what other could that be, and the only thing I could think of was that a ballot would be marked improperly in the oval, that the oval actually wouldn't be marked, but if there was somebody fill in an oval next to it, that somehow that could be counted as intent. And that's kind of where my mind went to when I saw this. So, and I guess the overall arching question is intent for me on this bill. So, and Mr. Chairman, just for what it's worth, since it's a new subsection, that means to me every word is worth scrutinizing. So that's how I kind of landed on that.
Good questions. While we're on that subsection, D2, I received, I think, Friday, an email from a thoughtful constituent in Anchorage who asked, you know, just, I guess, for the purposes of debate, why it is that we require that the oval be filled in for a write-in candidate when you've got someone who's gone to the trouble of writing down a name, a long name like Murkowski. It doesn't happen by accident. It's there as plain as day. The intent couldn't be any clearer. What sort of interest are we furthering through the coloring of an oval?
Mr. Chairman, the division simply is following a statute that requires that. I don't know that there is much more in it beyond that.
Well, let me ask Ms. Fenumani, how do we count ballots without a blackened in oval? What alerts the division to the fact that there have been ballots cast for a write-in candidate absent the oval?
Mr. Chairman, that would count as a blank vote. It would not appear in the tally for any candidate or in the write-in totals. The difference between times counted and ballots cast would be that would
reveal the difference.
Yes, that's true. And Mr. Chairman, during the recent U.S. Senate race court cases, the division did not count any ballots that did not have the oval filled in with the name written, and those were challenged by the Murkowski campaign, and the court did rule that no, the oval does need, there needs to be a mark, because you could perhaps, maybe they started to write the name in and then they changed their mind.
Change your mind.
So that ruling, that the process that the division followed for that was also validated by the courts.
Senator Wilikowski.
How many people wrote in a name but didn't fill in the ballot in the last election, do we know?
Through the chair, Senator Will.
The blank.
Wrote in the name, didn't fill in the oval.
I don't have an exact amount, but I think it was around 1,300, 1,400.
Wow.
Interesting.
Wow. Very large number. Very interesting. Huh. Yeah, I agree. Senator Pascan, point, or just a
no, I would
correction.
Just,
keep the record straight. Yep. Yeah, it was, I mean, it was, it's, I think, it's an interesting question, since you can see, you know, that intent by the spelling of the name. On the other hand, there is the possibility of a change of mind, or there is a possibility that it just makes it hard to bring those to your attention. So, but I guess I just need a little more, while we're making a record, ballot cast versus the other term is votes.
Excuse me, I think it's times counted. I don't have a copy of
times
the election
counted
results, but I can definitely get you that information if you like.
I'm just wanting to get familiar with it, because the terminology is a little bit abstract if you're not in the business.
I think it's times counted and votes, ballots cast, times counted, votes cast. I can't remember the exact words, but one signifies the total number of ballots that went through an AccuVote unit.
Run through the machine.
In a precinct, right. And then the other signifies the actual votes that were tallied, and the difference
the
between
ovals,
those
right.
are blank votes.
Sure. So if I go to the polling booth, get my ballot, decide I'm unhappy with every selection and can't think of a writing candidate, but hand it back to you and you put it in the AccuVote machine, that's a ballot cast, but no times counted.
Correct.
I see. Okay. Interesting. Further questions on that point? Senator Pascal.
Not on that point.
Yep. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. You know, one of my concerns that has arisen in this area, you know, my reading of the Supreme Court opinion, and I like that opinion, and I commented that, you know, the Supreme Court validating your common sense is, I think, marvelous. But it indicates in there that the Alaska Supreme Court, in reaching its decision, relied upon longstanding principles. They identified those, say that they had relied upon, or the courts of Alaska relied upon those consistently for 50 years, that the voter's intent shall prevail if it can be reasonably ascertained. And then they said clearly that, you know, common sense and reasonableness is validated. And, you know, the purpose of that is to promote participatory democracy. And kind of the reverse of that, though, is that the Supreme Court clearly rejected perfectionism as a standard. In other words, because perfectionism would lead to voter disenfranchisement. In other words, we want to count votes as compared to ignore votes. And my concern, and with the division of law here, is on page 2 in lines 20 and 21, when it says write-in votes that do not meet the requirements of this section may not be individually counted under this section. And I want to make sure that the intent of the Supreme Court, which they set forth at page 14, you know, when they say common sense statutory interpretations by agencies do not require regulations. The division's statutory interpretations were common sense interpretations and were not required to be promulgated in regulation, concluding a requirement that each such interpretation be preceded by rulemaking would result in complete ossification of the regulatory state. And so, you know, the Supreme Court has clearly said we can rely upon common sense and reasonableness, and I want to make sure that statutorily we are not going closer to the perfection standard. We're staying in the common sense reasonableness standard, and that this section on page 2 in lines 21 does not eliminate the long-standing principles that we've relied upon and does not eliminate common sense and reasonableness. And I want to make sure that that's on the record, so that 10 years from now or whenever it is, it's not somebody coming in and saying, oh, legislature changed this. Common sense and reasonableness and long-standing principles are out the window. So that's my question.
Ms. Numiak.
Chair, Senator Pascan. Section B in on that you were referring to, where it says write-in votes do not meet the requirements of the section, may not be individually counted under this section, that's referring back up to the requirements of A1 and 2, that it either has to be the highest number of votes for that race or the second highest within a certain percentage. So that's setting the standards, the ground, the standards, the framework for when you actually would have to individually go through and look at the write-in votes.
I just want to make sure that it is, you know, I voted for this at the state affairs level, but I just want it on the record so that, you know, if somebody's coming back and saying, you know, was it the intent of the legislature to get closer to the perfectionism standard as compared to remaining with the common sense and reasonableness, I want to make sure that it's clearly understood when it comes to your discretion or the future division directors. They are firmly in common sense and reasonableness, and we don't need to create regulations to run an election.
Yeah. Through the chair, could I just...
Please, Ms. Felix.
Yep. Ms. Benoumiai is correct, and perhaps, and you might want to ask Alpheus Bullard about this, but maybe to address Senator Pasfan's concern, it could, subsection B could be amended to say write-in votes that do not meet the requirements of A of this section may not be individually counted under this section, making it clear that it's just simply the numerical part of the statute that is.
We'll double check with the drafter. They've usually got good strong reasons for that language, but we'll get it on the record. I think it's a good inquiry.
Senator Cogg,
just a comment. The operative word I think on line 11 is only, and then it gives the bright line for when you would count those, and a section is a section, I suppose, but because that was how I saw it, was that you're only going to do this. I mean, it's a bright line if there's a close enough race to do it. Otherwise, you could burn up a lot of time doing it. So when I saw the word only, that made me ask the question, okay, why is that such a bright line? Because it precludes any other count. You have to have a reason to count. So it was a good explanation to me as well, but I saw the word only kind of drew my attention.
I have a question about this portion of the bill, and we'll just get it on the record. I think I know the answer, but you know, it's sort of funny in that the lines 10 through 14 sort of say you only count these ballots if they're the highest number, which sort of raises the question, how do you know it's the highest number if you haven't counted them? So maybe you can kind of walk us through how you get to that place where you begin counting write-in ballots.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. After election night, and if it's apparent that the total number of aggregate votes for write-ins is more than any candidate's name that is printed on the ballot, that then alerts us that we're going to have to go through and individually determine who those write-in votes are for, such as the process that we did with the U.S. Senate race in 2010.
So you know there's a whole bunch of write-in ballots out there. You don't know who they're for, ostensibly, because you haven't started looking at them to actually count whose name is written down. But you've been alerted to the fact that there's a whole lot of write-in votes.
That's correct, because when they're counted either by our hand-count precincts or by the AccuVote machines at the precinct, the touchscreen machines, they just go into a generic category of write-in votes.
I see. Very good. Further questions about that section? Let's back up one to page one, section three, lines 11 through 14. I didn't follow this case all that closely. I read about it in the newspaper. I didn't live it the way you did. I certainly wasn't involved in the litigation, didn't go to the counts. But I remember reading in three or four stories that this particular subsection seemed to get a lot of attention, I think from the Miller campaign, because it has this phrase, as it appears on the write-in declaration, on lines 13 and 14, and they were really hammering, as I recall, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, they were hammering that this phrase meant that it had to appear exactly as it appears. Is my recollection correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
And I remember reading this section and thinking that it could have been more artfully drafted. It just seems like it's just a hard sentence to get through. And I don't know whether you have considered tightening it or tweaking it, but if you have, this would probably be a good time to do it.
Through the chair,
Ms. Felix.
We did work with Mr. Bullard and Ms. Smith to do that. We moved the as it appears language so that it made more sense grammatically, and The main fix, of course, is your new paragraph 5 on page 2 between lines 6 and 8. That.
Okay, slow down. I missed you. I was actually looking to compare this new language with the old language and when you made your transition sentence. So tell me again what it is you just finished saying. I'm sorry.
And the real fix is on page 2 in paragraph 5 between lines 6 and lines 8, where the standard is adopted from the federal write-in ballot. That, combined
that's the
with
Supreme,
the grammatical fix to 3 and 4,
okay.
moving the as-it-appears language so that it makes more sense,
mm-hmm.
We believe would address those concerns that were so widely reported in the newspaper and were litigated in the Miller v. Treadwell cases.
Give me just 1 second so I can compare. And I'm looking back on the old backslash I, and I think the language that I really found confusing was subsection 11, lines 18 through 21. The candidate. I see. Yes. Yep. It is better. It's still not perfect, but it is certainly better. So I congratulate you and thank you. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it was probably discussed in the previous committee, but when I see the word disregard and abbreviation, how did you come to that? And that could be an area of contention. So help me understand how you would see an abbreviation. I can understand a misspelling or a minor variation, but an abbreviation begins to raise flags with me.
And just before you answer, I think Senator Coghill has actually brought us to the meat of the bill, which is the provision Ms. Felix just pointed out. For folks who are listening or later on reading the record, this is page 2, lines 6, 7, and 8 of backslash echo. Please go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, this language is taken from federal law for the federal write-in ballot, so we can't claim any pride of authorship, really, about it. It is a standard that is set out in many other state statutes that also mirror the federal law. And as far as an abbreviation, I see what Senator Coghill is saying. You've got a misspelling, a minor variation, so why are you saying an abbreviation? I can't really speak to that, and I did look at a lot of ballots with Ms. Fanumiai during the count, and I'm not quite sure how the abbreviation standard would apply. Maybe she has, maybe you have an idea?
Go ahead.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, my assumption would be that abbreviation would be perhaps just a shortened spelling of a name. I mean, I can't imagine an abbreviation like M period would.
Well, how about L period Murkowski? Would that be an abbreviation?
You'd have a last name on there, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I agree with Senator Pascvan that the common sense approach would apply here. But because they become contentious, I can see this could be a contentious area. It might be interesting to see if the federal laws had to defend this or define it, or if other states have had to defend it or define it.
Ms. Felix, any federal cases on abbreviations leap to mind here?
Mr. Chairman, I know that we did a lot of research and we found a lot of cases on misspellings. That's what we were looking at.
Sure.
And we didn't really look for abbreviations. But the point of L. Murkowski is well taken, that was something that we did see.
Sure.
And it doesn't limit it to the last name. The paragraph says in the form of the name of a candidate, so it could be a first name. It could be a first name initial, whereas the division would not accept a Lisa M., and the courts validated that approach. An L. Murkowski is a whole different kettle of fish, and that would be accepted.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think it will be possible for us to I don't think it'll be possible for us to predict every possible future challenge in future writing cases. And I think my intent in being a co-prime on this bill is to say that in the future the intent of the voter is premium. And if a voter abbreviates a name or accidentally misspells a name, or there's another minor variation of the name, but you can glean the intent of the voter, then that vote should be counted. That's my intent in
proposing this legislation, in supporting this legislation. And so I just think we need to be real careful when we start trying. We can go down a lot of rabbit holes in trying to predict every future instance where someone might make a mistake, but I don't think we'll ever be able to do that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Really, I wasn't trying to predict anything, Mr. Chairman, and I agree with the intent, so I intend to support the bill because I think any time we can clarify that voters' rights are protected, I think that's important. But there are two things that I'm kind of watching as we go down through this debate. One of them is the voter responsibility, because I think there is a responsibility we need to maintain. On the other hand, if we have a standard, we need to know any standard has to come with some defining points. Otherwise, we're going to leave it open to further discussion. And, if somebody puts the word John on the ballot, just who is this guy? You know, I mean, so I think for me it's something I'll watch.
Fair enough. Further questions about this section? Senator Pascman and then Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And just following up on the as it appears on the write-in declaration, obviously that was a source of a lot of contention, but would it help if on page 2 on line 6, after it says write-in candidate, would it help to add as it appears on the write-in declaration? Or is that getting... In other words, what we want to say is that we know that the write-in declaration may be different than what the voter is writing in, but we're still following intent.
Felix.
Through the chair, Senator Pascban, I would be concerned that putting that language in paragraph 5 might cause us some of the same problems we had with the other paragraphs where the as it appears language is set out, which we have just, I hope, fixed. The way paragraph 5 is written now, it seems cleaner, and it will be more apt to be applied even-handedly and without confusion.
Thank you. Senator McGuire, did that answer your question, Senator Pascan? I don't mean to push off your point.
We get back to common sense and reasonableness, you know, so that's what the Supreme Court said. And well, let me ask you this. If nothing was done by the legislature, would the standard be, as announced by the Supreme Court, be common sense and reasonableness?
Through the chair, if nothing was done by the legislature, the division would follow the Supreme Court's decision, which validated their practice. So they would just continue doing that, which is applying a common sense and reasonableness interpretation to write in ballots to effectuate the intent of the voter.
And that's a great answer, and I think it's probably worth taking a minute and just thanking you and thanking Ms. Fanoumiai for, you know, basically fantastic work in extremely difficult circumstances. And this really is, in a sense, a housekeeping bill. We're not trying to change anything. We're just trying to institutionalize, that chapter in Alaska's history in a statute so that going forward, perhaps there's less drama in the next write-in election 50 years from now. Who knows when it's going to happen. But I do want to take a minute and thank you for your good work. Senator McGuire.
Yeah, and thank you. And just following up on what the chairman said, I would also like to compliment you for your work. And I think under difficult circumstances, and I think what we want to do is reestablish credibility with the public, because it's our law that left you with the difficult job, frankly, in that nebulous territory of trying to reconcile what would seem to be common sense. Rectifying, both a voter's intent, clearly Lisa with maybe a Z, Murkowski, with a voter's intent, and the oval filled in with language that said, as it appears on the declaration of candidacy, with an S. And that's tricky. And so we're trying to clear it up. And I guess I just two questions. One, dovetailing into what Senator Pascan is saying, We write our statutes in interesting ways, and there are reasons for them, and I understand that, but sometimes I wonder if we get too convoluted. I like the way Section 13 is set out on page 2, lines 28 through 31, in one sense. And in another sense, part of me thinks that it ought to be read into any place where as it appears is, because I think that's the place where we get in trouble. That's the part where every talk radio show host was able to sort of hold on to that language and really say, no, I mean, it says as it appears. And it was difficult to argue with that. And if you were, I had people in my district who were not necessarily Miller supporters, but they were constitutional, I would say, people that felt very strongly about its principles and about statutes and that we should read them very plain lettered. And so one of the things that I'd like us to consider just as this bill moves through is whether or not we want to say as it appears on the write-in declaration of candidacy, however, or in some way saying, however, in considering that, the director shall disregard any abbreviation, misspelling, or other minor variation in the form of the name of a candidate in the intention of the voter that can be ascertained, so that it's read altogether. And I understand that there are reasons, and perhaps we want Ledge Legal to walk us through the ways that statutes are interpreted, and we know how that goes through the court process, but we also want citizens, average citizens, to be able to say, oh, that's a plain meaning right there. The common sense tells you that, yes, it's as it appears, but we'd like the director and average Alaskans to be able to say that, you know, we recognize that, you know, there might be a misspelling or an abbreviation or something that's read into that. We'd like you to have discretion. So I'd like the committee to consider thinking about how that ought to be reflected every place that as it appears is reflected, and I see it in both Section 11 and 12. That brings me to my final question, which is why do we set out different standards for the governor and the lieutenant governor versus other write-in candidates in Section 11 and Section 12.
Just a point of order. If you're on backslash E, I think you're looking at sections. Okay. That's okay. You're referring to the old bill, but just on section, you're talking about sections 3 and 4.
Yep.
So just to get us on that. Thank you.
Sorry.
Quite right.
So 3 and 4. So why are we referring to two different standards for lieutenant governor and governor and regular write-in candidates?
Ms. Felix.
Through the chair,
is that the Constitution?
Senator McGuire, it's my understanding that it's because the governor and lieutenant governor run together and you have to have two candidates written in.
Okay.
So for three, you just have the one write-in candidate, and for four, because the governor and lieutenant governor run together, you have to write in two names. And that's why you have to have two sections.
Very, very interesting. It's the first time I've had that point raised. Great point. I didn't realize it. So a write-in vote for governor, a candidate for governor, must contain not only the governor's name but the lieutenant governor's name as well, candidate?
Yes.
Wow.
Okay. And so just correcting.
That would be a great brain teaser in Alaska trivia.
So then just correcting it, Section 5, my apologies, that would then be read in, as opposed to Section 13. So Section 5 would be read into that particular understanding of as it appears or as they appear.
Well, I think I see where you're going, and maybe in Section 5 it needs to say, in counting votes for a write-in candidate or candidates, since you could be looking at a pair of candidates who've been written in for governor and lieutenant governor. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of where you are, Ms. Felix?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a correction. It's even more complicated than I...
Oh, good.
I know. Sorry. The way section, in version backslash E, the way section 4, paragraph 4 is written, you can just write in the name of the candidate, the last name of the candidate for governor.
Ah.
But you can also write in...
Oh, I see. Yes, on lines 3 and 4.
That's why they set it out separately, because it's complicated. You can write in the lieutenant governor's name along with the governor's.
You can do both or one.
Or one.
Yeah, okay.
apologize for being wrong. Then.
Everybody follow that because that is kind of buried there in subsection 4. Senator Coghill.
So just make sure I follow this. If the governor's name was in there, it would assume the lieutenant governor's running with him?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's the way it's written. At the very end of that subparagraph 4 on page 2, between lines 4 and 5, it says, or the name of the candidate for governor, as it appears on the writing declaration of candidate, or the last name of the candidate for governor is written in the space provided. So...
Here, this is, and this we need to finish this discussion and move on, because we do have another bill to present, and we are going to hold the bill over. But I just have to ask, can a person run for governor as a write-in candidate without a lieutenant governor partnership? And I know it's completely off the subject.
I know we have written an opinion on that subject, and I just can't recall exactly what it says, and I can get that to you.
It's purely a trivia question. If it crosses your mind, when you get back to the office, fine. If not, fine. Last question to Senator Pascan.
2 second question in page 2, line 6, where it says the director shall, between director and shall, would it add anything to say in the exercise of its discretion?
Shall the exercise.
We want to make sure that this is discretion that's being, common sense, reasonableness, discretion.
I think I'm going to pose that to the drafter. Yeah, I think that's it.
The Department of Law is here, and I'm not necessarily asking for an answer. I'm just wanting to make sure we're not going towards the perfection standard. We're staying. Mm-hmm.
You can ponder that. You don't have to give us an answer now. Ponder that and. Unless we have anything else on this bill, we're going to set it aside. Great work session. Thank you very much, everybody.
First blush.
And make sure we get SB 33 entered and started on today, because it's also a bill that is well-intentioned and well done. Senator Wilikowski.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to call up Michael Caulfield from my office to present the bill. If I
could. Mr. Caulfield, welcome.
Thank you.
Put yourself on the record. Giving us your last name and affiliation, and we'll hear your testimony.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Michael Caulfield. I'm an intern in Senator Wilikowski's office, and I'd like to thank Chairman French and the Judiciary Committee for hearing Senate Bill 33. In these times of war, it is vital we hold service members in the highest regard and treat them with all the respect that they deserve. This is never more important than in honoring their final wishes in the tragic event of their death while on duty. The Department of Defense requires active duty service members, reservists, and guard members to complete a record of emergency data form annually or prior to deployment, in which they stipulate who should manage the remains in the event of their death. The Coast Guard, which falls outside the Department of Defense but follows the same federal statutes, has their own form, the designation of beneficiaries and record of emergency data form. It's a mouthful. Unfortunately, many states, including Alaska, do not comply with the forms because no laws recognize legal designees as the person in charge of the remains. Instead, they default to predetermined lists, generally starting with the spouse. Clearly, this can lead to disputes where the person named on the form differs from the automatic default, and they both wish to have an authority over the remains. These situations can draw out an already painful process of mourning and burial. Senate Bill 33 solves this problem by amending Alaska statutes to recognize the person on the emergency data forms as the primary manager of the remains. This will stop disputes over who should have authority and help protect against the worst-case scenario when no one can be found to deal with the remains. Around 20 states already have laws which comply with the federal form, and in our doing so, we will be able to ensure our heroic soldiers' remains are handled by the person they truly desired. This bill is supported by the Alaska Veterans Association, the Office of the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, and the Alaska chapter of Vietnam Veterans of America. I'd also like to add that Mark Sansusi from the Office of the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense and Rick Davidge of Vietnam Vets for America should be available to provide additional details and support of this bill. Thank you, and I would encourage your support.
Good presentation. Thank you so much. Questions from the committee? Oh, come on, at least one. Senator Coghill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm a co-sponsor of the bill, so... I'm supportive of it, but I just for the record, one of the things that has always been a pain in the neck to me is us adopting the U.S. Code into our statute. And just in the research of this, this deals with specific issues on disposition. My expectation is we have to have the requirements before us in order to act. And I just wanted to make sure that that was clear. Because in Judiciary Committee, you're going to hear me bellyaching about every time we take a U.S. code and assume it into statute, this particular one, very narrowly crafted, very specific. So I just wanted to bring that up because I'm going against my own bellyaching usually.
I think as long as we live in a nation of states, it'll be an issue.
Yeah.
But I appreciate your perspective. Any other questions or comments? If not, we'll turn to public testimony. Thanks
all right,
so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
We do have Mr. Sanssouci, Mark Sanssouci, on the line, and we can start with him from the Department of Defense. If you can hear my voice, please put your name on the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Mark Sanssouci. I am the Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Northwest, working for the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. Given that two of the five committee members heard me talk about this last week, three of the five are sponsors, and five of the five are military-friendly, I think I'm going to err on the side of brevity on this testimony, if you don't mind.
I think you're a perceptive man, but go ahead.
As Michael so well put, the basic issue is that we'd like Alaska to have a statute that recognizes what the federal form asks of our military members. They're asked to pick before they deploy, and on a regular basis, they are asked to pick either a surviving spouse, a blood relative, or an adopted relative as someone they would want to handle the disposition of remains in the event they were obviously tragically killed in action or even crossing the street in Elmendorf Air Force Base. So this has bubbled up to become a problem where the federal form, DD-93, in some states, in many states, either don't recognize it or the choices on the form are not in alignment with state statute. So we've been asking, based on these, on this bubbling up as quite an issue since late 2009, this has been in our top 10 list, we've been asking states to please take action to do something to recognize the 93. And so at this point, as Michael said, 20 states accept the DD-93. 10 states last year passed legislation into law recognizing the DD-93. This year, so far in the early in the legislative session, we have 9 more states, including Alaska, taking this up. So it has the support of the National Funeral Directors Association in the person of John Fitch. And we ask for your support, and I'm certainly here to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Excellent presentation. I don't see any hands up, so thanks so much for taking the time out to give us your perspective. Let's turn now to Rick Davidge. Mr. Davidge, well-known to those of us in the legislature, and a pleasure to have you here in our committee. Go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Delighted to be back before your committee. Rick Davidge, I'm the president of UVA in Anchorage, and also, as you know, chairman of the Alaska Veterans Foundation. We've been involved a number of times in not only active duty deaths, but also certainly veteran deaths. And having been in the middle of those family disputes, I can tell you it would be very helpful if the state fell in under the 93. A couple of specific points. I appreciate the changes that were made by Mr. Senator Walchowski's staff to recognize the difference with the Coast Guard. We sort of all forget about that, but they now operate under the Department of Homeland Security and are not in the Department of Defense. I would tell you that the Anchorage Funeral Home Program, per se, and for certainly Virginia at the National Cemetery here, are extraordinarily helpful and work together very, very closely. Not only with the service organizations on base, but also the veterans community in these kinds of situations. Just to touch for a moment on some of the things that are happening in the veterans community dealing with this, we have a program now that's joint with the Providence Hospital, and we're working with Alaska Regional so that no veteran dies alone. We've had that happen. And recently, veterans that do die alone outside of these institutions are not buried alone.
And again, the funeral homes here in Anchorage and certainly National Cemetery and the person of Virginia there are very, very helpful in ensuring that that takes place. But we strongly support this legislation. We encourage it to be passed in session. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Davidge, for your testimony and service in many areas. I don't see any questions for you. Is there anybody else online or in the room who'd like to testify on SB 33? Don't hear or see anyone. With that, I'm going to close public testimony, and we will hold the bill over just to give folks another day to look at it. But it's my intention to move this on Wednesday. Senator Codgill.
One question. Because of what we're doing, is there any reason we have to let the bill go through without an effective date? Does it matter that is there a reason that we couldn't put an effective, immediate effective date on it? Or is there some technical reason why it couldn't just be specifically dated, or is the time issue? I'm just thinking about those who see it coming and may have an expectation. Just have brought it up. We can bring it up next time around.
Fair question. I'll let the prime sponsor ponder that, and we can make a decision about that at the next hearing or before, and make a change if necessary with very little effort. Anything else? Excellent. Thanks so much for everyone, and with that, we are adjourned.